Welcome to Sex, Body and Soul. I'm Kate Roberts, founder of The Body Agency, and on this show, we talk about the marvel that is our bodies, what they can do, and what they need to thrive. Ladies out there, our time is now. Let's get to it.
Have you lost your libido? Do you often not feel in the mood to have sex? Are you perhaps going through menopause and it's like the Sahara Desert down there? Or do you perhaps suffer from vaginismus? These are very common problems affecting hundreds of millions of women and men around the world. Our next guest is going to help explain why these things are happening to us and what we can do. We are joined by Dr. Sharma Matthews. She's a board-certified OBGYN. As both a mother and wife herself, her goal is to help women of all ages maintain their own quality of life while keeping up with the day-to-day needs for their families and careers. Her practice emphasizes the importance of patient education and empowerment to make the best possible decisions for themselves and their bodies. Welcome to the show. Dr. Sharma, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Well, we're about to talk about my favorite subject, and that is pleasure. I am just thrilled to meet other lionesses who are charging through the world, helping women to get their sex drive back, be in charge of their bits and pieces, and a healthy libido. So my first question to you is, you are extremely well qualified. I've already introduced you. What made you become a doctor and what made you want to focus on this particular subject?
Sure. So I did not go into medical school thinking I would end up in gynecology. I did always have sort of an inclination towards healing and helping and wanting to do something nurturing and kind of caring. That medical aspect, that science behind it, was always something interesting to me. And that's what sort of took me down the path of medicine. And then during those years of training, I got the experience of working with women. And I think that's one of the things that really drew me towards obstetrics and gynecology, was having women as patients and addressing their specific needs. And then I fine-tuned that training into gynecology specifically and surgery, because I like working with my hands.
Mm-hmm. So we hear endometriosis flashed around all the time. Can you give us the definition of exactly what this is and what problems it causes?
Sure. So endometriosis, it's a condition where there are cells that are very much like the cells that we have inside our uterus, the cells that sort of build up every month and shed for our periods. So cells similar to that, that respond to those same hormone cues, are found places they don't belong. So that could be outside the uterus. It could be on the, what I call the walls of the abdomen, the wallpaper, it's the peritoneum. It could be on the bowels, bladder, within the ovary, causing certain cysts. And the thing is, it's an incredibly inflammatory disease. So where it resides, these implants, they start causing inflammation and fibrosis and scarring, and it can be incredibly painful. So painful periods, painful bowel movements, GI problems, urination issues, pain with sex, lots of issues associated with that. And it can start at, unfortunately, a very young age and progress over a woman's lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Is that why some babies grow outside of the womb?
It can be. Mm-hmm. One of the things that it can do is cause scarring in the fallopian tube. So it's not the only reason. That would be called an ectopic pregnancy. It's not the only reason for an ectopic pregnancy, but it is one of the things that can cause that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you are also a specialist on menopause, and specifically when women have lost their libido during menopause, one of the many things that you do. And I'm wondering if when you are having sex, and let's say you are in perimenopause or menopause, and you bleed or you have pain during sex, apart from what you've just talked about, why is that happening?
Sure.
And is it dangerous?
Sure. So first of all, postmenopausal bleeding, so bleeding in menopause not associated with any kind of penetration or friction, not specific to sex, that should be investigated to make sure that there isn't something abnormal going on. So that would just be postmenopausal bleeding. Now, pain with intercourse or bleeding with intercourse often suggests something is going on vaginally with the mucosa. So the lining of the vaginal walls, they really change. They're very dependent on estrogen. So as we're kind of navigating through perimenopause, menopause, and our estrogen levels drop, those tissues really suffer. They thin out. Mm-hmm. They don't create as much lubrication. There's a lot more friction. There can be tears. It can be very painful. So all of that can circle back and then start affecting libido as well.
Now, many women complain that it's like a Sahara Desert down there when they are going through menopause. Why is that? What has happened?
It's exactly that. The loss of that estrogen has decreased the amount of lubrication that's there. It's changed the pH. It has thinned that lining. It makes it very dry and not as elastic. It's not as accommodating. So it becomes very painful and exactly Sahara Desert, dry and uncomfortable. So it's directly related to that loss of estrogen.
And even if you feel turned on, would it be the case that because of your loss of estrogen, even though you're feeling turned on and aroused, that you don't get wet?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's the case.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Understood. What would you say are the top reasons that women lose their libido? What are some of your patients that come in talk about?
Sure. So menopause and perimenopause is probably the top one that I discuss. And a lot of the times it's related to dryness or discomfort with intercourse because sex shouldn't be painful. So if it's painful, that tracks back to then losing the desire for it because your body doesn't want to respond to something that's going to elicit pain. So there's that menopause component. Other things that can affect libido are often medications. So whether it's hormone medications like birth control, antidepressants, other medications that are used for other conditions as well can sometimes impact libido. So that would be mm-hmm. kind of the two things there with relation to libido. And other things would be medical conditions like we just talked about endometriosis, fibroids would be another one, ovarian cysts. Again, things that elicit pain and discomfort with intercourse for various different reasons.
Oh, so many questions. So let's just get back to the birth control mm-hmm. for a second. So there's so many different types of birth control, right? You can take a pill, you can get an injection, you can get a patch, you can use condoms. I mean, there's just so many things that you can do. Are there particular brands or any advice that you have on, you know, we were just talking to our producer, Kelly, and she had this question, right? What birth control can you take that doesn't affect your libido?
Sure. So you're right. There are so many different options. And then within the choices, so for example, under the category of birth control pill, there's also 100 options and different formulations. Mm-hmm. So it often becomes a very individualized decision-making with the provider and the patient trying to figure out what's the best fit. Sadly, a lot of women don't mention loss of libido as something that they're experiencing. And sometimes providers don't think to ask about it as related to their birth control use. So the thing is, all of these medications, most of them involve hormone. And so if you're playing around with hormone, some people's bodies respond a little differently where libido can be impacted. And there may be others that use the same thing and the libido isn't impacted. So you have to fine tune which one is the best fit for a person. And that mm-hmm. might involve a lot of different considerations. Like if you're doing it for other things besides contraception, like controlling bleeding, heaviness, or painful cramps, or other PMS symptoms, you kind of have to weigh all of those things. There are one particular option that's non-hormonal besides condoms would be a non-hormonal IUD. And then there's also hormonal IUDs, which are sort of more localized and less systemic. So it's actually more focused to the lining of the uterus, which may be better for some women. Mm-hmm. So it really becomes individualized, you know, as far as choosing what's the best thing.
Mm-hmm. And on the IUD, can you clear up any myths that they give you cancer? I mean, so we've got to say it every single time because the awareness out there is still so much stigma attached to an IUD.
Yeah.
Tell us what the medical science is behind an IUD. Is
sure.
it safe to use?
It is incredibly safe to use. There's decades worth of data. There is a non-hormonal option that's copper, has no hormone in it at all, and works as a contraception for 10 years. And then there's also progesterone locally delivering low dose progesterone options that are approved for 5 to 8 years and are wonderful options for contraception.
Now, you mentioned something interesting before. You said that a lot of patients, when they come in, don't bring up their loss of libido because, you know what? It's embarrassing, right? You go to your doctor, you see that doctor, I don't know, once or twice a year, maybe. If you're lucky, you get the same doctor and you can build some form of a relationship with your doctor. But, you know, I've been in in a doctor's office before with my legs in the stirrups, you know, it's getting a pap smear or whatever. And it's, first of all, it's mortifying. And second of all, when he or she is down there and sort of his head pops up and it's like, so, you know, are you having regular sex? Are you doing it with one person or multiple people? And, you know, I think this is rarely talked about, that medical bedside manner sometimes leads to embarrassment. The medical providers are not trained to ask the right questions or how to ask them. And it's already a mortifying experience for a woman to be in that chair with her legs open with a spatula up her vagina. It's uncomfortable. We're trying not to think about anything sexual. And I particularly remember when I had IVF to get pregnant. And I remember when the doctor was actually either retrieving the eggs or putting the eggs in, he was chit-chatting away to me about Samantha and Sex in the City and all the antics that she was getting up to. It was the last thing that I needed to talk about was to hear about Samantha's vibrator, you know, as he is there between my legs, either inserting eggs or taking them out. So I would love your thoughts on that. Now, you're obviously, Sharma, very personable. You know, you're friendly and you're warm, and I'm sure you have a wonderful patient rapport. But what are your thoughts on this? And do you get that training at medical school?
It's lacking, I would say. They make a valiant effort to try to teach patient interaction and verbalize, you know, how you do an exam and how you deliver bad news and how you counsel someone, et cetera. But I will tell you, conversations surrounding sex and sexual wellness and libido, it doesn't come up a lot in our training, not even in residency in OBGYN. Do you spend time? How do you ask these questions? How do you leave it as a safe space and an open place to have that kind of comfortable conversation with a patient? Because you're in a very vulnerable position, right? And you want to be able to feel like the person that you're speaking to about it isn't just checking the answers off in a box, like that they're really hearing you and want to address any issues that you may, you know, feel open enough to share. Mm. So it really comes down to that.
And you know what also blows my mind is men and boys' engagement in our issues. And I think this is just a forgotten area of behavior change in education, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I actually now have a lot of men listening to this podcast because they are able to learn about women, why we do what we do, how our bodies operate. And, you know, they get tips because nobody is telling them. Nobody. Their parents aren't telling them. They're not educated at school. They have no idea about our periods or birth control. And then forget about it with menopause. You know, they don't even want to ask the questions, right?
Right.
They are not educated and they are not sympathetic because once the symptoms start to happen, they just avoid.
Right, absolutely.
So, yeah. And, you know, we actually, at the Body Agency, we have a campaign called Body Next. And it's all about educating our next generation of youth, both men and boys and girls and women, because an old dog doesn't change, what is it? A dog doesn't change its spots, right? So if we can get them young, we can, you know, having a man understand how our bodies operate, in my mind, is world changing. Having the medical community, like people like yourself, get trained up in how to have these conversations, getting parents mm-hmm. to have the tools, you know, like the Vuppet, as in, here is your clitoris, everyone, right here. You know, it's world changing. So if you get onto the topic of Roe and Wade, actually, I don't want to get political, but a bunch of men decided to put a gag order in place so women could not have access to abortions. Now, I would love your opinion, Sharma, on, you know, if you think about it, a bunch of men made that decision, right, in political roles. But these same men are having unprotected sex with their partners who, in their mind, it's their responsibility to take the contraception, right? Because they're not doing it.
Correct.
But then they're not allowing abortion. So talk about a libido killer right there, right?
Yes.
What is your opinion on this? Again, I don't want to get political. I'm not on either side, but what is your opinion on this?
Sure. So I would tell you my concern surrounding Roe v. Wade is actually broader than just abortion care. Like, I 1,000% believe abortion care is important, but also contraception access, mm-hmm. STD screening, yep. all of these other availabilities for education in certain populations that don't have access to commercial medicine and commercial insurance. So that's what you're really stripping our society of. You're stripping our society of that access. And so, like you said, you have these men who may not be practicing safe sex and are counting on the woman to be the one that's in charge of the contraception. But now you've just taken away her access to get proper contraception and talk to a provider about what's the best option for her. So it becomes a big, I think, a broader issue. And I think part of it also that gets me is that, you know, this decision is being made and it truly is a gag order. It's impacting women. Yeah, it's impacting their sexuality. It's impacting their, you know, how important that is in their lives, and trying to put that away again, put that where it's hidden and we don't talk about it. And it's not something that, you know, should be accepted and embraced and educated across the board, that everyone should have this education. So I think that's the bigger issue.
Yeah. I used to live in Russia, and the main form of contraception in Russia at the time, this was in the 90s, was abortion. As in, so many girls would get pregnant mm-hmm. all the time, mm-hmm. and because they didn't have access to contraception, and they would just have abortions nonstop.
Right.
You know, a friend of mine had 12 abortions. Can you imagine? Goodness. And it's just wrong. It's just really wrong. Okay. So let's get back to the issue of losing your sex drive. Mm-hmm. What are some of your tips? Now, we've talked about the power of estrogen, right? I am a huge fan of estrogen, a huge fan. Like, I take it every day. I feel great. It's great for your hair. It's great for your skin. It's great for your libido. It just pops back. What are the other things that you recommend?
So I, too, am a big fan of estrogen. I think hormone mm-hmm. therapy has been too long shamed and miseducated about, that we really need to come back to the importance and safety around that. But beyond that, I would say lubrication is incredibly important. pH balance is mm-hmm. incredibly important. So using products that are good for your tissues and that aren't going to throw off your pH, that's only going to support those organs. And then also making sure that you're not dealing with dryness or irritation, because again, that sex shouldn't be painful piece of it is really important. I find that incredibly important. So it doesn't matter of your age. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, menopause related. If you're having intercourse, that should be kind of a go-to standard care product that you have available to you so that you can have comfortable and pleasurable sex.
So let's talk about that a little bit more. So I was just telling you that I have acquired an olive grove in Italy and I've been experimenting with developing a pleasure oil for the body agency. Like, we all know that also lube is king, right? And you're involved with a lube from Playground, which I'm really excited to try and see if it's something that we would love to carry. But pleasure oil, I have been involved with trying out, you know, in all of my career, I've worked in sexual reproductive health. And with the organizations I've worked with, you've always had to use the products that you promote, mm-hmm. everything from female condoms to pleasure oil to lube. Like, I just try it all out. And with the body agency, what we try to do is get the best of the best products. And then, you know, that's what we put our credible stamp on. And that's what we use. Now, let's talk about lube and pleasure oil. This olive oil, pleasure oil that we're developing will just go on the clitoris. Because as we know, the clitoris is where the arousal begins. Am I right?
It is. On a woman? For many women, yes. Yes. That's sort of the primary location.
Uh-huh. And I think it's fair to say that just so when we're talking about anatomy, the man's penis at the top is the equivalent of our clitoris,
correct.
Right? If you rub that, he gets aroused. If you rub the clitoris, we get aroused, right?
Correct.
Okay. So, I mean, this is all very basic stuff, but you would be amazed, Sharma, how many people do not know this.
I believe it.
And how many women don't understand what we have going on down there.
Yeah. From a scientific standpoint, it's really interesting because embryology, like when we develop as tiny cells that are developing, those two parts are the same. And then that's what diverges based on our genetics, male versus female. So it's really interesting. They completely are parallel.
Yeah. No, I was looking at diagrams the other day and I was like, we have the same parts. One is external and one is internal. It's just really, really interesting. Anyway, I want every woman in the world to know where her clitoris is and to have the stimulation she needs, whether it's from her partner, an oil, a lube, whatever it may be. They need to know about this. And it just shocks me how people just don't know.
Or herself.
By herself. I mean, also, that's where it would start. You know, that's what I want to teach kids. You know, I have a very funny story, actually. So I'm part of the World Economic Forum, and I met another young global leader who was from India. And I was at the forum giving a talk on this very subject of, you know, pleasure, basically. And he told me that when he was 13, he was a 13-year-old boy, he had a wet dream in India where he grew up. And, you know, he sort of woke up with what he said was this white stuff in his underwear. And, you know, he went to his brother and said, you know, I think I have cancer. This has happened to me. I don't know what to do. And his brother said, go and speak to your father. He went to speak to his father, told his father what had happened. And his father took him to a mental institution and basically said, you need help. Mm-hmm. Now, that to me is the worst thing you can possibly do to a young person. And talking to them about masturbation, it's just so normal. And it's how we as humans understand our bodies and understand how to get the pleasure that we want. And it has to start there. I know it starts around 12, 13, 14. Everyone's different. But why is it such a taboo? You're a mother like me. I have a soon to turn 13-year-old daughter, and I chase her around the house with the velvet puppet. But why is this still so taboo? Why are people in India, and sure all over the world, you know, not teaching their children?
All over the world, right? It's not just
all over the world.
It is. It's not all just conservative cultures. It's every culture. There's very few, I would say, that globally, that within their culture, really discuss sexuality, intimacy, pleasure. I think it's very much so, just over the generations, been considered something very shameful, secretive. It's not something that's universally spoken about or educated around. Even in what we're teaching our kids, you know, in school or whether it's health class, I don't think parents have the education or the language around how do you talk to your kids about this. I think even providers as in medicine, it's somewhat kind of hit or miss where you can meet, you know, a pediatrician or a gynecologist that's comfortable talking about those topics. So I think there just needs to be all around openness about it and more education surrounding it. And really just people and a generation, like you said, you were focusing on coming forward saying, you know, we want to know these things and we want to be able to talk about them.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll do that when I next take my daughter to her gynecologist and ask her about masturbation and see what she says. I'll put it to the test. There is something horrifying, though, when you're thinking about your own daughter. I mean, I get it. I get why. Look, I'm in the business and I get it. You know, you've got to be able to have the conversations about porn and sex. And, you know, boys are getting their education from porn now. That's where it's, or TikTok or Instagram. I mean, it's pretty horrifying. So, yeah, I mean, I love doing this podcast and hearing also from the medical community about, you know, what are some of the things that we can truly do? Because I get so passionate about this subject and, you know, I don't always know what the solution is, but the solution is with the youth. Okay, I want to get back to your day job where you are both, you know, performing surgery and dealing with things like fibroids, doing hysterectomies, and really looking at pelvic pain. Can we talk about chronic pelvic pain? And what are some of the reasons that we're getting that, you know, often our stomachs are really bloated. It doesn't matter whether, you know, you have a period or you're in menopause, like what is causing that? And what are some of the solutions?
Sure. So chronic pelvic pain is pretty complex. It's defined as, you know, 6 months or more of pelvic pain that's persistent. It could be menstrual pain surrounding, you know, periods and a cyclic nature, or it could be non-menstrual, non-cyclic pain, like constant all the time. So defining some of these things, finding out some of those things, keeping track of some of those things are really important. There may be a gastro component, like where a GI issue, like intestines, bloating, constipation, diarrhea, those kinds of symptoms might be also associated with it. Some patients also have urinary issues. So frequency, urgency, pain when they pee, negative urine cultures. It's not a UTI, but it feels like a UTI. That's usually a common complaint surrounding it. Mm-hmm. So it can be any one of these things. And pain with sex, that's the other part of it too.
Yeah.
And many times this pain can be, you know, central, but it can also radiate. It can radiate down the legs. It can radiate to the back. So really kind of defining all of these components and these characteristics helps you walk down the possible diagnoses. Does it have to do with endometriosis? Does it have to do with vaginismus, which is the sort of clenching of the vaginal muscles?
Yeah.
Is there pelvic floor dysfunction? I love talking about that because a lot of women have it and have no idea what it is. It's where the muscles of the pelvic floor aren't acting appropriately. They're tense all the time and they're causing pain locally because of that. And that can climb into global pain as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty complex topic, but it's something that I truly love educating around.
So there is a lot that goes on down there as a woman. And I think, again, that both men and women don't really understand all the issues that can come up. And I remember one time having a UTI, a yeast infection, and BV all at the same time. And I was in hell. And my partner did not understand why we weren't going to have sex. And I'm like, well, if I was you, I would not want to go down there right now. And it was horrible and it was painful. And it all just sort of, you know, it's not an STD. Mm-hmm. None of those are an STD.
Correct.
Those are natural things that happen to you as a woman. Mm-hmm. And they are so common, right, Sharma?
So common.
So common. And is it normal to get them all at the same time?
It can happen.
Do they help each other to ferment?
I would suggest in a situation like that, the underlying issue is probably a pH imbalance, because that's what sort of causes the overgrowth of these things. Again, things that we have yeast, we're supposed to, we have bacteria, we're supposed to, but if they're overgrown, that's when they become symptomatic and become these, you know, true infections. And often something like a pH imbalance can contribute to that.
Mm-hmm. And what causes a pH imbalance?
So lots of different things. Mm-hmm. You know, primary things may be related to hormone levels. So things like perimenopause, menopause can lead to it. Hormone changes related to medications, like we talked about before. Dietary things, other medical conditions, diabetes, for example, that is out of control. So there are many things that can contribute to that.
And what role does the gut have in this? Because one thing I've been learning is the gut is the center of everything. Mm-hmm. Like if your gut is off, everything goes awry. So what role does that play and how does it translate to some of these issues?
So, you know, we talked about pH, we talked about these different things. Our gut, which is a huge organ system, has its own microbiome. It has its own balance that it's supposed to have. And I think we take it for granted. We take it for granted quite a bit. We put all sorts of things in there, all sorts of foods, processed foods, chemicals, et cetera. And I think that's one of the things that really gets thrown off. And you have to be really careful and take care of it in order to keep it in a good, healthy balance. Because inflammation is often sort of the root of many of these issues, and they layer on one another. So if you've got gut issues because, you know, what you're eating isn't sitting right with you and your body doesn't know how to process it, that's generating inflammation. And then if you have other issues related to your cycle, your periods, whether it's fibroids, endometriosis, et cetera, that's also adding another layer of inflammation. So these things become sort of a bigger problem, and then multiple organ systems are then affected. So I agree with you. The gut is incredibly important. I often suggest, mm-hmm. you know, dietary changes for when patients bring these issues up.
Mm-hmm. And how do you feel about probiotics?
I think probiotics can be helpful. Now, there are probiotics for different reasons. There's probiotics for gut health, and there's probiotics for vaginal health too. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind them is that you're trying to replenish some of the healthy bacteria that's supposed to be there, trying to maintain that pH. Now, it's not going to be the only thing, but it can sometimes help replenish that bacteria in those areas.
Now, let's talk about vibrators for a second, because you know, I was toying with the idea of finding a little starter vibrator for my daughter at some point, maybe putting it under the tree. Seeing as we're talking about pleasure oil and we've talked about masturbation and self-pleasure, how do you feel about vibrators? And is this something that you would ever bring up in your practice if somebody was to come in and talk to you?
Oh, absolutely. I happily discuss vibrators, masturbation, libido, all of these topics, because I feel like that's where they should be getting some of that information from and having this sort of safe space to discuss it with, right? So sometimes I'll bring it up so that they don't feel embarrassed to talk about it. Mm. I think vibrators can be helpful. I think that particularly a lot of women that I talk to don't have an understanding of that anatomy, don't have an understanding of their clitoris, haven't really quite figured out how to reach pleasure, whether it's with a partner or on their own. Many haven't even really tried on their own. It wasn't something that they ever felt comfortable with, or again, culturally, there's a lot of shame around that. So encouraging women of all ages, I'm talking about, you know, postmenopausal women sometimes be like, hey, why don't you see what's different about your body? Try to figure out what works for you. And sometimes I think a vibrator helps, you know, figure that map out for you.
Mm. I think communication as well is so important between two different partners. And, you know, whether it be a man and a woman, a man, or, you know, however that happens, I think a lot of women are embarrassed to ask for that extra help, whether it be a pleasure oil or a vibrator. Like, again, the shame that goes along with losing your sex drive, or, you know, even going through menopause is embarrassing for a lot of women. And then being able to find the way to talk to your partner about it so that you can actually get a sympathetic partner to go through this journey with you. I just think it's really hard. I mean, do you have any thoughts on that, of some things that can be addressed and tools that you can get?
I agree. I think that is communication and being able to openly speak with your partner about what your body is going through, what you need, giving them some direction as well. I think that's really important. But you're right. I think a lot of women are embarrassed to talk about it. Again, I think it stems from education. I wish we had some more resources, honestly, to be able to guide our partners as far as, hey, this is what's happening to my body right now. I'm still learning about it and understanding it. Yeah. You know, would you like to come to my doctor's appointment with me so you can ask your questions too? I often encourage that. So, you know, whatever we can do to kind of share that information, I think really in the long run does help.
Okay, last question. Mm-hmm. Anal sex.
Yes.
First of all, is it safe?
Absolutely.
It is safe. It is? Just doesn't seem safe to me. But anyway, it just seems a bit strange. But okay, so it is safe. Why is it so painful? And it often leads to infections because of the transfer of bacteria. Any thoughts on anal sex? Why do some women love it and others don't?
I think anatomically, we're a little bit different, everybody. Where we achieve pleasure varies from person to person, right? There's no one recipe for that. So I think anal sex is on that list of options for a lot of people. I think it's something that some people are open to trying and they're comfortable around it, which is great. If they're not, they're not. And that's okay too. But particularly for sometimes partners aren't able to have vaginal penetrative sex, sometimes exploring anal sex might be an option for them. So some people find it pleasurable. And there may be things to do such as lubricant, making sure that there is appropriate sort of arousal surrounding it as well. Both people being open to it and wanting it as well, because if you're apprehensive or clenching or uncomfortable with it, that's not going to aid in the pleasure at all. And then as far as the infection piece, I think that's also important. Mm-hmm. Being careful about that transfer of bacteria, cleanliness surrounding it, you know, just being mindful of that as well.
Yeah. As in, don't have anal sex and then have vaginal sex straight after without washing, because you are guaranteed an infection after that. You brought up, and this is the very last question, you brought up vaginismus. Now, vaginismus, I heard a statistic the other day that 50 million women suffer from vaginismus. I would like your medical definition of vaginismus.
Sure.
And also any thoughts that you have on a solution. So if you could dumb it down a little bit so people understand really what it is and why you're getting it.
Sure. So the first thing to remember and learn and understand is that the vaginal walls are a network of muscles. So we have muscles surrounding our vagina that support our bladder, vagina, and rectum. That's our pelvic floor. So what vaginismus is, it's the spasm and tightening of those muscles. And it could be psychologic, it could be physiologic, it could be provoked, it could be unprovoked. And there can be a lot of downstream things like other kinds of pelvic pain, back pain associated with it too. But most of the time it comes up as not being able to place a tampon, having pain with intercourse, anything penetrative being painful or impossible sometimes. Many times women describe it as, I feel like there's a wall there. And that's the, you know, cause for concern. Mm-hmm. So it's really a clenching and spasm of those muscles, not allowing for anything to enter the vagina. And it could be because of a lot of different reasons. It could be because of pain, meaning having a history of pain, whether it's painful periods or having had painful intercourse previously, other kinds of trauma. Absolutely. Trauma can lead to it. Sometimes it's actually cultural as well, because that idea, yeah, religions and cultures that are, again, not so open about sexuality, and that can lead to sort of that physiologic and psychologic response to intercourse. So there's a lot of different components.
Yeah, we did an interview with an Orthodox Jewish lady, Julia Hart. She has a Netflix show called My Unorthodox Life, and she was telling me that obviously she had an arranged marriage, and sex, you're taught in the Jewish faith that sex should not be pleasurable. Sex is for making babies. And so when it came down to it, she had to recite religious prayers during sex, and her husband was not allowed to even look at her vagina. So of course, there's not going to be, and she said something like, I preferred doing laundry than having sex.
Oh my gosh.
I know, but if you think about the cultures mm-hmm. that are around the world, mm-hmm. right? Whether it be Muslim, Jewish, Catholic, there's all sorts of, you know, taboos and religious beliefs in the Catholic religion, mm-hmm. especially Roman Catholics.
Correct.
So yeah, vaginismus is a real thing. Mm-hmm. And again, a vibrator or a dildo could be really helpful with some lube, right? That's pretty much the solution.
Yes. So yeah, what I typically recommend, dilator therapy, which is using dilators, basically it's kind of like a dildo. It's sort of more clinical in the sense that it's, you know, not meant to be related to pleasure, but more so in the actual mechanics of slowly inserting.
Getting it in. Mm-hmm.
Yes, dilators of different sizes to slowly kind of help your body adjust to having something there of a certain size and working through that. I am a huge, huge fan of pelvic floor physical therapy. I think every woman should experience it at some point mm-hmm. in their life. We all probably need it at some point in our lives. And I think pelvic floor physical therapists are incredible educators surrounding this. So many times that's another avenue that I'll suggest to a patient. Mm.
Well, Sharma, you're amazing. Thank you so much for being on the show. I've really enjoyed talking with you. I have so many more questions, so we're just going to have you back. But really appreciate your vast knowledge and how you're caring for the female population out there. So thank you for your good work.
Thank you so much. I'm so impressed with all that you do as well. So this has been incredible.
Thank you. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Sex, Body, and Soul. Remember, you can find all my favorite products and resources to support your health and sexual wellness through my one-stop shop, The Body Agency. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a rating and review on your favorite podcast listening platform. We are actually partnering up with Vital Voices to get much-needed dignity kits to the refugees in Ukraine. Girls and women do not have access to personal hygiene products that keep them safe and healthy. Please go to thebodyagency.com to donate a dignity kit today. Be sure also to sign up for our email list at The Body Agency for the latest curated recommendations from our industry experts, and use our special promotional code PODCAST10 to get a 10% discount. Thank you for listening.